If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
Illinois Congresswoman Nikki Budzinski has had a whirlwind entrance into electoral politics. The Democrat from Springfield began her tenure representing the state's 13th congressional district with a fractious speaker election. But now that the dust has settled, Budzinski is seeing room for common ground on committees handling agricultural and veterans affairs issues. Budzinski joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to discuss her first impressions on federal legislative life. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, an in-depth examination of Missouri and Illinois politics.
The instant we got to Illinois, we joined the Green Party. This was 2000.
So I've tried to push for those that I think are honest and really care about the future of the city.
You know, this wasn't a path that I thought I would choose in 2012 when I was able to win the closest Republican victory in the nation.
If it's something that will help Southern Illinois, I'll work with them on it. If there's something he's doing wrong, then you got to fight him on it.
I believe very strongly in the Second Amendment. I believe less government is better, and I believe local control is better.
I choose to fight for working families and for union members.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me for the first time on this show, St. Louis Public Radio's Metro East reporter,
Will Bauer.
Well, thank you for joining us, and also a first-time guest. She represents Illinois' 13th congressional district in the U.S. House.
Nikki Budzinski, great to be with you.
It is an honor to have you today, Congresswoman.
Thank you.
And before we pepper you with hostile and incendiary questions, can you just describe to our listeners what the general boundaries of the 13th District are?
Sure. My home is Springfield, so that's about an hour and a half from where we are today in the studio. The most furthest eastern part of this district is Urbana-Champaign. I'm a graduate of the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. It weaves through Monticello, Decatur, Illinois, my home Springfield. It takes in almost all of Macoupin County and then large parts of Madison and St. Clair counties.
Have you found it challenging to represent a district that kind of, you know, it's thin, but it's, you know, wide east to west, you know, when there's, you know, Granite City and they may have completely different needs than Urbana-Champaign on the other side of the state?
Well, it takes me about 3 hours to drive from the most furthest eastern part of my district to the most western part. My home being Springfield is actually great geographically located because it's right dead center in the middle of this district. So I will tell you, I spend a lot of time, windshield time in the car, driving through roads and cross bridges. And so I can definitely speak to the importance of infrastructure investment for sure. But I actually have always said about this district and really do believe this, that there is a lot of common both opportunities and challenges that confront central and southern Illinois counties that I represent in Congress. We have great universities as a part of this district. We have obviously SIUE, the University of Illinois, my alma mater, but we also have great community colleges too. Parkland, Richland, SWCC. These are great community college systems. I am on the House Agriculture Committee, so farmland obviously interconnects all of our communities throughout this district. And then also, obviously, we have a lot of infrastructure needs, a lot of workforce development needs that come along with those opportunities as well. And I would say on the challenges front, you know, one of the things that I've really been trying to focus in on is some of the issues around food insecurity, food deserts. What are we doing with the recent news, for example, in Cahokia Heights with Walmart has just announced that they're going to be leaving the community in April. What does that mean to the community in access to healthy food options? That's not a unique issue just in Cahokia Heights. I hear about that also in Springfield and in Decatur. So some of the same challenges and opportunities are interwoven throughout the 13th district. And I've been enjoying visiting with all the communities as I've been home for recess.
So you were sworn in for the first time in January 2023. What's been the most surprising thing that you've encountered since becoming a member of Congress?
The one thing I'd say throughout the campaign I heard about was just the complete lack of civility. I think people saw when they were sitting at their couch at home watching CNN or Fox or what have you and seeing just political dysfunction in Washington. And so some of my expectation was to go to Washington and find that. And of course, there is some of that. But I would say I made it a mission of mine in this first 100 days to really reach across the party aisle and work on issues where I feel like we can still find common ground. And I'm here today to successfully tell you that I think we've been able to accomplish some of that. Whether it's been on some of the agriculture initiatives I introduced on a bipartisan basis, Next Generation Fuels Act, also on a bipartisan basis introduced a workforce development bill called the LEAP Act that provides small business tax credits for people that are being hired through apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship programs. Also in Springfield, an issue that's very important to my home is making sure that we are making a national monument, the 1908 race riot incident and that happened. And so with Congressman Darren LaHood, together we introduced legislation to make that a reality. So finding some common ground, I think, might surprise people that I've been able to do in this first 100 days, but we've been successful at that.
I wanted to bring you back to maybe the start of your tenure, which kind of happened at an interesting time with the election of the U.S. House Speaker. And it was, it had never happened before, 15 votes, right? So what did you make of all of that? And what would you say, you know, have Republicans maybe regained their footing, or are internal divisions kind of still present for maybe Democrats to be impactful in some way?
Well, you're totally right. It was a historic week, taking 15 votes to get to what is usually a simple pro forma vote, which is the Speaker of the House. By the end of the week, I will say it was frustrating. I mean, without a Speaker of the House, that meant that we didn't get our committee assignments. I was very eager to get to the work of whatever committee assignment I was going to be able to receive. It took us several more weeks, actually, after that to get to it because of the delay, as there was a failure to launch, so to speak, of this new Congress. But now I can tell you we have gotten to more of the work of it. So I'm getting to serve, as you mentioned, on the House Agriculture Committee, the House Veterans Affairs Committee. Both of those committees are doing really important work, I think, to help working people throughout central and southern Illinois and the communities that I'm privileged to represent. We're finally getting onto the work of it. I think some of what you're seeing is like a slower start to some of our farm bill negotiations. The farm bill actually, it expires at the end of this year. We really need to be making more progress on that front. But I am starting to now see that the wheels are moving. We're starting the process. I just actually participated in a six-hour hearing. Secretary Vilsack, the Secretary of Agriculture, came before our committee, and that was one of the last things I was able to participate in before coming home.
So let's stay on that topic. House Veterans Affairs and Agriculture are your committees. What have been the big issues that you've maybe encountered so far in your first 100 days?
Well, one of the first things I did once I got assigned to the committee is I set up an agricultural advisory council. I thought that was really important that we establish people locally from the district that I could hear from on a regular basis on the issues that are going to impact the negotiations of the farm bill. On that council, I've got the Soybean Association, the Corn Growers, the Illinois Farm Bureau. I also have Republican State Representative Wayne Rosenthal, who represents Macoupin County. We have representatives from the USDA. So I really wanted a diverse set of voices to help inform me and get me smart and educated on how I can be the best advocate for the communities of Central and Southern Illinois. We did that. At the course after launching it, I mean, I heard about a lot of great opportunities, I will say, for our communities. One is through ag research. You have SIUE leading with a biotech center here, not too far from where we are. The University of Illinois has a world-class ACES college program for people going into agriculture education. Parkland Community College is the only community college, I believe, in the country that is actually certified in precision agriculture. So education is really important. Research is a really important part of the farm bill. So I've been really leaning in and working on some of those issues. I mentioned biofuels. Biofuels is another really big issue that comes out of the research that a lot of these institutions have been doing. How are we supporting biofuels? And in exchange, because of that, then we're able to support our family farmers, the corn producers that are here in the area, lower carbon emissions, which is a great thing for our environment. And then third, hopefully through the passage of something like the Next Generation Fuels Act, lower the cost of gas for consumers at the pump. So looking for those kind of win-win opportunities through the House Agriculture Committee that, again, are bipartisan and make a real difference.
Speaking of bipartisanship, I looked at the roster of the Agriculture Committee before we press record. There are 5 members of the Illinois delegation. So everybody from Jonathan Jackson in Chicago to Mary Miller. So it runs the ideological gamut. Have you found that there's been consensus about like what specifically the Illinois delegation wants to get out of the Agriculture Committee?
Well, I think this is a great opportunity for Illinois to have such strong representation on this committee. And I think it really points to the fact that the agrarian economy is the number one economic driver for the state of Illinois. And so I think the fact that there are 5 of us on the committee really underscores that point and the importance of agriculture to our state. You know, when I talked to Congressman Jackson, you know, one of the things I know we both very much care about is the nutrition program. The nutrition program actually makes up a little over 80% of the total budget for the farm bill. That's incredibly important, as I mentioned, for communities that, you know, working people that need a little bit of extra assistance. They're working, but they can't afford some healthy food options, making sure that kids get warm lunches at school. Really important programs that the nutrition title provides within the farm bill, and that I can find common ground actually across the aisle on some of those issues. When it comes to people like Congresswoman Miller, you know, she actually is a co-sponsor of the Next Generation Fuels Act that I just mentioned around biofuels. She, too, is a big supporter of biofuels. So I think the Farm Bill offers a lot to a lot of different communities, and I think that's why there's such a diverse set of voices on the committee.
I want you to talk more about that ethanol bill. What exactly do these bipartisan group of legislators want to do that would change ethanol policy from a federal level right now?
So what light-duty vehicles, for example, the Next Generation Fuels Act basically would allow for more use of ethanol, more use of biofuels into the mix, which would then make for, you know, vehicles that create less carbon emissions with the mix of ethanol and biofuels, hopefully bring down our reliance on oil, so bringing down the cost of at the pump for consumers. And then again, in order for us to do this, we have to produce corn. And as you know, Illinois is the number 2 producer of corn in the country. Iowa is number 1. We're the top producer of soybean. So investments like this in ethanol and in biofuels actually allow us to really give back and support the family farmers, but have a lot of other additional important benefits.
To Veterans Affairs, where you also, that's a committee also chaired by an Illinois person, your neighbor to the south, Mike Bost. What do you think of his leadership of that committee and the impact maybe it has for downstate Illinois and I suppose Scott Air Force Base, which is just adjacent to your district?
It's a very important question. Congressman Bost was one of the first members that I met during new member orientation because we do share St. Clair County. I will say I've had the privilege and opportunity to tour Scott Air Force Base. Even though Scott Air Force Base is just outside of this district, it is a very important economic engine and driver for our region as a whole. And certainly people that work at Scott Air Force Base live in the 13th District. So I've offered to Chairman Mike Bost, if there's anything I can do to be supportive of Scott, I want to be there for him. So have offered that. I will say, I think a good working relationship with Mike. And I serve on the subcommittee, the health subcommittee. On that committee, I'm particularly focused on rural health care and how we are providing rural health care to our veterans. I have 2 clinics within this district. One is in Decatur, one is in Springfield. There are CBOX in both of those 2 communities. But obviously, the St. Louis Veterans Hospital is a really important thing for the constituents of the 13th District, just on the other side of the river, where veterans are getting some really critical care. But in rural America, and a lot of the 13th District is rural, We face some really unique challenges as it relates to access to specialty care. And what I mean by that specifically is behavioral health. For veterans, it's so critically important that we're making sure that they get access to behavioral health no matter where they live, whether that's in an urban setting or a rural setting. And in rural settings, that is a challenge. It's why another piece of bipartisan legislation that I'm leading in the House is the Rural Health Core Act, which basically would say to medical professionals that are getting their training, whether you're a nurse or a doctor in a rural community, you want to stay in the rural community, which we're hoping that they will. If they stay for 5 years, we'll be able to relieve them of some of their student loan debt significantly. And I think that's just a good way to help incentivize people to not leave, to stay, shore up the needs that we have for rural health care. Lastly, I would just point to just making another further example of how real this is on the behavioral health front. In Decatur, since I've been sworn into office, St. Mary's just recently announced they're no longer providing any behavioral health care. So when you see that in any of our communities, especially in the rural parts, it's scary because who is going to absorb that lack of care? And so really trying to find out how we're going to be able to still provide it. The need is still there, but we're losing providers. So we need to find ways to address it.
Yeah, that gets me to my next question. You know, I'm basically a Missouri-based reporter, and keeping rural hospitals open here is just as much of a problem as in Illinois. And a lot of it seems to revolve just around the reality that a lot of rural communities in Missouri have just lost population, and there's just not a demand for health care as there was 20, 30, 40 years ago. So is there anything that government can really do to reverse those trends and create a environment where you would have medical professionals open up there? In other words, is this really a governmental problem, or is it more of just a demographical problem?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think that's why I did want to lead on this Rural Health Core Act, which would help to incentivize bringing back healthcare professionals and keeping them in our rural communities. But I will say, you know, some of the other pressure points on rural healthcare, when you look at Decatur, I use St. Mary's as an example. Decatur has a very high proportion of its healthcare population on Medicaid. And so that, too, it's an increased strain on the system in making sure that we can keep these hospitals solvent and they can meet their bottom lines. So it's really not just a federal issue. I agree with you. I think this is really something that states also need to be partnering. I hear a lot from our hospital systems about reimbursement rates, how that creates more of a challenge and pressure points on our rural healthcare systems as well. So I think we need a collaborative approach as to how we're going to address this. And there are a lot of great hospitals that we do have in this area that we want to make sure we're doing everything we can to help them stay solvent.
I wanted to transition to another place that you've, I believe, toured in your first 100 days, and that's the U.S. Steel plant in Granite City. It's created a lot of news. And I know there's a lot of uncertainty about, you know, for the a few thousand people that work there, but also the future of the community if that sale does indeed go through. So given your history working for unions, mm-hmm. what's your kind of read on the situation and potentially what it could mean for Granite City and the surrounding community?
Well, it's not a done deal that they're leaving. It's just the proposal on the table. I obviously would like to see them stay. And so I've made it a point to, tour the facility. I visited with U.S. Steel, with SunCoke, obviously also as somebody that's worked in the labor movement, making sure that visiting with the Steelworkers Union, all obviously still in a negotiation as it relates to this proposal that's on the table. But I think, you know, I support ways that we can, provide incentives. The Department of Energy, for example, does provide grants right now for companies like U.S. Steel if they wanted to transition their blast furnaces into electric arc furnaces. There are grants available for them to do that. Hopefully, maybe that's something that they would do, and I would encourage that. I think at a bottom line, and it's scary when you realize that if this proposal were to go through, it would mean costing upwards of 1,000 jobs for the Granite City community. Anything I can do to encourage and keep U.S. Steel there, I want to be doing. I also think that this challenge is not a unique challenge that a lot of Midwestern communities are facing as industries are taking a look at their footprint and what their future plans are and what are the next generation of business and economic development. I want to be a partner in helping some of these rural communities think through that. And I think we can do that through a lot of different means. I just had the Undersecretary of USDA, Sochi Torres-Small. She runs the Rural Development Office at the USDA. They have a lot of really critical grants that can be provided for economic development, for housing. Housing is a huge issue that I hear about throughout our communities. And so how are we able to also be supportive of communities like Granite City and their future planning? Whatever that looks like as a federal partner, that's what I want to be.
So let's talk about some of the issues that you may be facing in the near future. The biggest one is the debt ceiling. Mm-hmm. I think that there's currently a showdown between Republicans and the Democratic presidential administration about what will come of that and what the overall package that gets the debt ceiling raised will be. What have you heard on that front? And how optimistic are you that there can be any form of compromise when it seems like both sides have such diametrically opposed viewpoints?
Well, I think the debt ceiling gets conflated for two separate issues. One is that this is a spending thing. This is actually, these are bills actually that are just coming due. So I am expected to pay my bills. I'm sure you're expected to pay your bills. The government should pay theirs. This is spending that has already been allocated and appropriated. So we need to pay our bills so that our economy does not default. I think it's very dangerous, the game of chicken that we're seeing as it relates to some of the issues that Republicans are indicating that they might hold hostage to raising the debt ceiling like Social Security and Medicare. I will never support that. Social Security and Medicare are earned benefits that working people have been paying into their entire careers. They deserve those as soon as they retire. We can't allow that to be a part of this negotiation. And that's why I signed with a lot of my other colleagues a letter to the president saying and calling for a clean debt ceiling lift. And that's what I'm hoping we get, and that's what we should be working toward. But I think if we want to have a spending conversation, we can have a spending conversation, but that is a separate one from the debt ceiling.
Do you think Democrats are going to have to maybe temper expectations about new major spending programs in light of, you know, limited government, a split House and Senate, and kind of lingering questions about the impact of inflation on everyday Americans?
Yeah, I will say inflation still continues to be probably the number one issue. I think people are still dealing with difficult decisions at home as it relates to paying for groceries or pumping gas. I think that is still what is consuming most people's day-to-day, and we need to be finding ways to make things easier for them. And so that's why I've always consistently been supportive of things like middle-class tax relief. I also believe the child tax credit, which is something that is a tax credit for working families with children at home, struggling to make ends meet, helping them to keep more of what they earn. And so I think we need to be laser focused on that in Washington and where are those opportunities to help people keep more of what they earn and save money, because inflation is still the number one issue. I do think as it relates to Washington and things that are possible to happen or not happen, even in a narrowly divided House and Senate, I'm really hopeful that is a farm bill. We need a farm bill. Our farm bill expires at the end of this year. What that would mean if we let that linger would be harmful to working families and family farmers, our educational system. So we need to be focused on getting that across the line. It's also why I was so excited to get to serve on the House Agriculture Committee, because I do think even with narrowly divided Congress, this is something that that committee could potentially really get over the finish line. I think FAA reauthorization is something. There are some bigger bills that I still think could potentially move. But for me, primarily focused inflation, helping people with their everyday expenses.
I have a follow-up on the child tax credit. So the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee happens to be a Missourian, Jason Smith, and I talked with him after he was given that chairmanship. And what he has said pretty consistently is he would want to find a way to expand that program, but he wants to make sure that there's a work requirement on there. And mm-hmm. I think that that's been primarily the point of contention between Republicans and Democrats. What's kind of your thought about that?
Yeah, I think work requirements, look, I think we need to make sure that they are not major barriers to people being able to get the relief that they absolutely have to have. But work is good. We need to get people back into jobs. That was certainly something that I heard about throughout my campaign. We have labor shortages. Getting people back into the workforce is really important. But I also think we need to acknowledge that there are still very significant barriers. Two in particular, childcare is one. Childcare is something that is still, I would argue, a broken system when people have to pay the same amount in rent for the month as they pay for their childcare. And then those child care providers are probably only making just over minimum wage. We need to do something better about making sure that child care is accessible and affordable. I think public transportation, we need to continue to be making investments in our infrastructure. Those are two things that I think help people get back to work. I'm not opposed to things like having people work in order to get benefits, but I think it's just very important that there's a balance to it, that it's not such a hindrance that people can't take advantage of the needed benefit they need for their kids.
I wanted to also ask you about the indictment of former President Donald Trump and how you think that's maybe going to impact the House's business, especially since some GOP legislators have, you know, said they want to respond to what happened in New York. And there's also things at play with, Georgia and January 6th. How does that...
Yeah, it's a sad day. I mean, I think what I would say is what you did see is that no one is above the law. And I think that's an important point that needs to be made, whether you're a former president or a CEO. If you've broken the law, you're going to be held accountable. And so I, like everybody else, are watching this case unfold, and we'll see what the end result is. But I think it's important to allow the judicial system to play itself out in this case. But what I would say, these kind of things are really frustrating because, as I was just saying, people care about how they're affording their day-to-day lives, struggling with that. This kind of a major distraction from a former president or, you know, all of this that's happening just prevents us from getting, it's a distraction from getting to the work of the people.
And that was going to be my next question. How do you think that the presidential race writ large is going to affect mm-hmm. how Congress acts, especially next year? Because oftentimes, like in Missouri, for example, when there's a governor's race, the legislative session gets impacted. I'm sure if there's a governor's race in Illinois, same thing. How do you think it would translate itself into federal politics?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is election years are always, you know, they add an additional layer of kind of complexity to policymaking is just probably the truth of it. But what I really hope is that it does not become an overwhelming distraction from the things that we really need to be focused on. Middle-class tax relief, getting a farm bill done, bringing back federal infrastructure dollars is something I've also been very focused on. Those are the things that I think we really need to be, no matter whether it's an election year or not.
On the topic of election years, given that you've worked for the Biden administration and you're a younger Democrat in terms of the House, I wanted to ask you. I wanted to ask you specifically about Biden's campaign for reelection, if he does indeed go forward with it. You know, what do you think of maybe all the discussions probably from some younger Democrats that would say Biden and the older generation should maybe step aside?
I guess what I would say is I think by all metrics, by all measures, it seems like President Biden is going to run for reelection, and I would be supportive of him, obviously, if he decides to run, which it seems like he will. I think it's really more about getting things done again. So, like, looking at the body of work that he's been able to take on in these last several years. I mean, I will say when I had the chance to work at the Office of Management and Budget, his administration's ability to kind of meet the moment as it relates to providing relief to working families, getting a bipartisan infrastructure bill done. I think also some of the key, I think, successes being like capping the cost of insulin for those on Medicare at $35, Medicare being able to negotiate prescription drug prices, that's lowering the cost of prescription drugs. I think some of the work he's doing, obviously, internationally, restoring our alliances and strengthening our relationships with NATO, I think all of that speaks to his work, and it should really be more about the work of it. And so that's at least how I'm looking at 2024.
Before we let you go, we mentioned the debt ceiling. We talked about child tax credit. Are there any other major conflicts that you foresee in the horizon over the next few months or so?
Well, I do think it is the debt ceiling. I think it's the budget, I think getting that done. I think a lot of it also is around implementation. There have been some really big pieces of legislation that passed in the last Congress. So, for example, the PACT Act that now is going to expand healthcare coverage for veterans that have been exposed to burn pits as an Iraq war or Afghanistan veteran. Making sure that we're implementing that is something that the House Veterans Affairs Committee is going to be really focused on. I think some of the other, it's around implementation, I think, is going to be really interesting. So I'll, continue to obviously be following all of that.
Well, Congresswoman, thank you so much for your time. And the next time you're in St. Louis, you are always welcome to come back and talk about whatever issue is top of mind.
Thank you.
For all of our stories, go to stlpr.org. Politically Speaking is a part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, a listener-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis. And Congresswoman, how could people find you either in the digital world or elsewhere?
Online, you can find me at Budzinski, budzinski.house.gov, or on Twitter at Rep. Nikki B.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.